From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Janine Basinger is my guest. A renowned film historian, she is the author of many books, including A Woman's View, How Hollywood Spoke to Women, 1930 to 1960, the World War II combat film, Anatomy of a Genre, Silent Stars, and books about Gene Kelly, Shirley Temple, director Anthony Mann, and her most recent book, The Great I Do and I Don't, A History of Marriage in the Movies, which we discussed in detail here a couple of years ago. Janine Basinger, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It is my pleasure to be here.
We spoke last time. I Do and I Don't was just being published, so it must have been gratifying for you to see how well it's been received.
It really was a wonderful treat for me because, as I think you and I talked about, it actually turned out to be a hard book to write. It was a more challenging subject than I'd realized. So I was very happy to see how well it did and how many people were super interested in the topic, way more than I realized.
Oh, it's such a great book, and I hope everybody will run out and read it. It's so great.
Thank you.
And I've been reading some of your other books. Now, I recently read your book, Silent Stars, which is now available as an e-book, and
yes,
I found it just so fascinating. What a great, great journey into silent films. I think it's my favorite next to, along with, I'll say, The Parade's Gone By, Kevin Brownlow's.
Well, that's great a book. Great compliment. Thank you very much, because, of course, Kevin Brownlow is a god. Writing Silent Stars was a labor of love for me. I love silent films. I love these stars I wrote about. But I had never thought about writing a book on them or on the subject, but my editor, who is the great famed Bob Gottlieb of Knopf, really sort of talked me into it, and I kept thinking, no, but as I got into it, I realized I did have a lot to say, and I love these films and these stars so much. They're really fabulous.
It's such a sort of a sad story, the story of silent films, because silent films, it's almost a separate art form from the talking film. It's kind of a shame that both types of film could not endure together.
Well, you know, it is. That's a really smart thing to say, and I always think that in a way the greatest of the sound films do not rely on dialogue. They emulate the great silent films, and so a lesson was learned there, and so in some ways it does endure, but I remember once when I was at Eastman House many, many years ago, the James Card, who was the curator and, of course, a great man and a great lover of silent film, said that those people like him who had grown up with silent film, when sound came in, it was like that this beautiful woman that they worshipped and adored had opened her mouth and turned out to be Gene Hagen in Singing in the Rain. You know, it seemed so diminished to them. The art form seemed so diminished. And I think that when you watch silent films, you are so drawn in, you do not miss sound. You don't feel that people aren't talking. You just don't actually notice it when you're watching them, because they're so involving. Don't you agree?
Oh, I agree completely. It's interesting because if you today the way people watch movies, they notice I say watch as opposed to seeing. You know, we
yes,
say I saw a movie, but
yes,
people say I watched a movie.
Yes.
They're watching it on TV. They look away. They look at their phone. They get up and go to the kitchen with the movie playing in the background. But with a silent film, you can't look away. You must.
Exactly.
You've really got to be in a theater in the dark to appreciate them. And I guess every silent film was not only meant to be seen in a theater, but meant to be seen in a theater with a few hundred other people.
Well, you know, your point is so astute in that with a silent film, you do not look away. You do not get up and go to the refrigerator if you're watching at home. You don't go out to the lobby for popcorn. You know, you have to give it your full attention. And it's nowadays we're so casual in our viewing. I agree. I mean, television has taught us the VCR, the DVD, all these devices have taught us, you don't need to pay attention. You can stop it. You can start it. There will come a break in it. You're in control. It's not the same experience that I had as a child when I first started watching movies. It's not what I think of. I mean, for me, I'm going to surrender to it. I want nothing going on. I don't want anybody. As my husband says to this day, I'll shriek if somebody comes in and I'm watching a movie. I mean, I want to be absorbed in it. And that's a whole different attitude, I think, you know, from modern viewers.
So how about your film students? Do you still show silent films? And
we do, and not only that, we have impeccable theaters. If we show 3D, we show 3D. If we show 70 millimeter, it's in 70 millimeter. It's something that I cared about. I raised the money. We built the theaters. If our students are studying Lawrence of Arabia, they're watching a 70-millimeter print of Lawrence of Arabia, and I'm happy to say that's the case. And we're trying, you know, you're working against your culture in some ways, but we're pretty, I guess we're just a bunch of old fogies, but students don't bring, you know, they can't bring their little telephones in, they can't, you know, they can't text, they can't tweet, they can't come late, they've got to be there. We're asking, give this art form the respect it's due, and we're very fortunate. The films do the work for us. Once the students begin to see them, they instantly understand, they appreciate, and they are willing to do that. So the more films are shown, the more young people have the opportunity to see great films under the right conditions, the more the art form will live. The more people showing silent films properly, the more people will want to see them.
When I was a kid, I grew up around the corner in Los Angeles from a theater called The Silent Movie.
Ah, yes.
And they showed silence all the time, and I went every week. So I got to see all the great silence, or at least a good
lucky
portion
you
of them on the big screen, like
lucky you,
Seventh Heaven and Tollible David. And
oh, yes. Isn't that wonderful?
So I developed my favorites, and of course the comedies. But what about you? When did you first, what was your first exposure to silent cinema?
Well, my oldest sister, I'm one of a family of girls. I'm the youngest. My oldest sister was a student at the University of Chicago. And when I would visit her in summers or during the year or whatever, there was a silent film screening there all the time, and she would take me to them. So I began seeing them under decent circumstances. I mean, with piano accompaniment, fairly good prints, and, you know, someone who was older than, you know, trying to introduce me and share a love that she had, because she also loved silent films. So then I began trying to seek them out, and at a fairly young age, I started going to Eastman House and, you know, seeing the screenings there and asking to be shown more. And I pretty much tracked them down wherever I could and saw them as much as I could. It wasn't always easy, you know, depending on when you were born. You know, you didn't have DVDs. They weren't showing them on television. You sort of had to track things down, but I did the best I could and, of course, began collecting prints of them, as many people did, that sort of thing, you know.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're talking with Janine Basinger, the great film historian, and at the moment we're chatting about silent films. You know, I want to talk a little bit about the acting in silent films, which is called pantomime, but should not be confused with mime, or the things that people do on the street when they're inside a glass box or whatever that, and they're walking against the wind. And it's a marvelous style of acting that I think a lot of people mistakenly consider overacting, which it's absolutely not. It's just acting. And when you look at a scene like in The Hunchback of Notre Dame, when Lon Chaney, and he rescues the girl from, he swings down on the rope and he carries her to his room, and And then she looks at him, and at first she's startled, and then she gives him this kind of loving pat on the head. And it's all done, of course, without any talking. And there's so much love conveyed, and such a touching moment where at first he sees that he's shocked her with his appearance, and then he sees that she's accepting him. It's just a beautiful sequence.
Yes, it's people forget that, you know, the people making silent films are very smart. They quickly figured out that the theatrical performance style of the late 1800s and early 1900s that was very suitable for the theater was not maybe suitable for a medium that could come in very close, that could show subtlety and nuance and small gestures of the sort that you so eloquently describe. And they adjusted accordingly. And there's so much tenderness, there's so much detail of feeling that is very simply and subtly demonstrated in silent film. It's a wonderful experience to watch, and just as the tragedies or the sad films can do that, the comedy films can make private little secret jokes or give you little winks or little twinks, little catch you with little things that are really hilarious that you wouldn't notice otherwise. I mean, silent film is a subtle art, and it's one that requires intelligence from the viewer and treats the viewer as if there is intelligence present. And it creates an intimate relationship with you that you really, it is private. I mean, we talk a lot about going into the old movie theaters, the beauty, the quiet, the silence, the big screen, the silvery look it had. Everybody talks about this, but to have experienced it, to experience the way movies were, you know, it's very different from the modern viewing experience. The relationship created with the viewer was truly intimate and private, and you looked for these little things that you're describing, and they were little secret moments, and that just gave you so much when you went to the movies. And I know we still have things like this. I like modern movies. I'm a big movie fan. I always will be. But the silent films have something that you don't see today. They really do.
It's interesting, too, that silent films from 1927, 28 are so much better than talking pictures from 1929 or 30.
Yes.
You write so well about Mary Pickford in your book Silent Stars, and I watched a few of her films, and then I saw her, I think it's her first talkie, the one that she won the Oscar.
Yes.
And her acting in that is absolutely terrible. It's just atrocious. The way anybody speaks in the movie, they don't understand how to just talk like normal people. And also, and this is so surprising, because you'd think, you know, after, you know, the silent films were so much, music was such a part of them, the orchestra playing in the pit, mm-hmm. and that they would not put music under dialogue, that they hadn't considered putting music under dialogue. So most of the scenes are so quiet. They're truly silent in those early talkies.
Yeah, they're dead is what they are. I mean, the dead sound around them. But, you know, they fell back on what they thought would be good theater technique, which meant push it hard and get up to that little old lady that's in the back row at the top of the balcony and maybe has a hearing aid. I mean, you know, they forgot that it was a different medium. They thought, okay, now we're doing dialogue, and they fell back on theater technique, which was not appropriate, and they kind of shattered it there for a while. But they quickly did get a grip on it, and of course, the quality of sound recording improved, their ability to cut, you know, do sound editing. I mean, everything, they quickly did get it better. But there was a big change there. There is a big shift. When you add sound into the motion picture, you take on a harder reality in some fundamental way. You take on noise. You take on guns, and you take on people yelling, and it is. I always think, as I've gotten older, it's like once I thought it was great to be in a really noisy restaurant. Now, God forbid I should be in a noisy restaurant. First of all, I can't hear. And, you know what I mean? Your relationship to sound shifts. And because they had the ability to give sound, they created stories that were sound stories, like gangsters, musicals, things where you needed sound. And so you have a big shift there all of a sudden in things until it kind of gets back to normal.
Yeah, I mean, I think by 1931, I guess.
Yes.
I think Grand Hotel is a fabulous example of an early sound picture that's as good as any.
They get a grip on it. They, you know, they were businessmen. There was a lot of knowledge of science and people thinking creatively about everything and figuring it out. It's amazing, really, how quickly they adapted. I think the audience probably adapted more slowly than the business in some ways. I mean, historians either say the transition to sound took 5 years, or perhaps it took 5 minutes. I mean, you know, I always say, I think it was 45 minutes on a Friday, because, you know, in terms of solving many of their physical, technical problems, they got right at it. It was the aesthetics that took a little bit longer for everyone, and that's always interesting, really, to see.
I don't think people realize this today, but far more people went to the movies then than go to the movies now.
Oh, my goodness, yes. I think when I was a little girl in World War II, I was a little girl in World War II. Yes, I was, people. There was a World War II, and I was there.
I read a book about it. No, World War II, yes. Combat film.
I know, really. I mean, the thing about it is every 89%, they say, of the nation went to the movies every week. I mean, huge percentages. I mean, well, you had radio, but you didn't have TV. You didn't, you know, people went to the movies. It was cheap, and it was fabulous, and they put out an enormous amount of product. Now a film can stay in the theater for a long time. That didn't happen there. Like, if you lived in a small town, it maybe played 4 nights, whatever. You know, you went, and then you saw it, and then something else came. I mean, it was a constantly shifting program of exciting and glamorous things of all different kinds of stories, and it was what people did for entertainment for the most part, and the movies were huge.
I think more people saw Mammy with Al Jolson than have seen any of the Twilight movies.
I bet you're right. Of course you're right. You would be right. You know, isn't that a thing to think about? I mean, really? And also, you know, people do see movies now a lot, but not in a theater. They maybe look at them on their computer or on, you know, some other device, TV. They don't go out to the theater. But in our day, my day, certainly, if you wanted to see a movie, you had to go to the theater. That was the only place it was playing. And if you missed it and it went away, it wasn't coming back.
You couldn't see it on your phone.
No,
in a week.
I was sick when I was too young to go to Wizard of Oz, really, when it came out, or my mother thought I was. But when it was reissued when I was in about sixth grade, I was very sick with the flu during the 3 days it was there, and I didn't get to go, and this was the heartbreak of my life. I will never see Wizard of Oz in my life. And now, you know, you turn on your TV, or I can own it.
That's right. Most kids now have seen it so many times by the time they're 3 years old. They can remember.
It's a completely different world. Just a different world.
It really is. We're talking with Janine Basinger, and she is the great film historian. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. You talked earlier about Singing in the Rain, which tells the story of an actress whose voice doesn't fit her. And that's kind of the legend of what happened to a lot of silent stars. And we know that for one reason or another, many silent stars did not make the transition to sound. And obviously, writers of titles had to find another profession, and tons of theater musicians, too. But what about other behind-the-scenes people, like directors and so forth? Did they have trouble making the transition?
Well, some did. I mean, you know, it was people. I talked a great deal about this subject with Frank Capra, who was a director that I knew really very well. And, of course, he was there for the transition to sound, and he was a college graduate. He had gone to what is now Caltech, and he didn't fear microphones. He didn't fear technical change, and he talked very eloquently about the shifts and about how some people could adjust and some couldn't. And I think that most really successful film directors continued to think visually, even when they had the new tool of sound added in. Others played with sound and thought of it as really what they wanted to do and made their mark with it. Of course, having sound opened up jobs, sound editing and recording and boom operators and all kinds of microphone specialists, and you know, so it closed down some jobs and some people, but it opened up others, ultimately more scoring. Of course, it created the whole genre of the musical, which really hadn't existed before. I would say piano players in theaters were out of luck, and others. But one of the things I think that did happen is that when careers, let's say careers of stars, were more or less ended by the coming of sound, it often has to do with something other than the actual sound of their voice. I mean, someone like a Vilma Bankey, who was a delicate, beautiful-looking woman who had a sort of heavy Hungarian accent, I mean, it didn't match the way she looked. That was a problem. But other people like Garbo, it didn't harm her at all. The fact she had a foreign accent was not a problem. Some people like Joan Crawford had beautiful speaking voices, and Norma Shearer. So it kind of depended. One of the people, of course, that's always talked about is John Gilbert. But, you know, I did look at all of John Gilbert's sound films, and after the first couple, when they got a grip on sound recording, his voice was fine. He was actually a very good actor, and he did make sound films for a good 3 or 4 years. His career was more destroyed by his own personal demons than really his voice. But one of the things that happened was he was a figure of romance, a beautiful man who would be wearing a Cossack's outfit or a perfectly tailored military uniform, and he was romantic, and he would kiss the hand from the fingers up to the elbow. I mean, the times changed. People were done with that kind of romanticism, and they wanted more like a Clark Gable, a rougher guy who might play a boxer or a gambler. You know, times changed. So it wasn't just the coming of sound that destroyed some careers. Sometimes it was about just the need for newness, a different kind of star, a new style of acting, a new type, just that kind of shift. And of course, in Gilbert's case, you know, he had personal demons that undid his career also, you know. So it's complicated. It's complicated, really.
Fortunately, our heroes, Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy, had no problem.
Those two men could be great no matter what, with, without sound, without anything, they're geniuses.
Their voices fit their characters so perfectly.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Now, I wonder if there was some thought to that. I mean, did Stan Laurel, I guess, was the brains behind Laurel and Hardy. Do you think that they said, listen, we're going to try various voices and see which ones work?
Well, I don't know, you know, that really, but I do know that having had stage experience and having played vaudeville, I mean, a lot of the early, not all of them, but some of the early comics, you know, they had been in front of live audiences, so they understood sound and they weren't afraid of it. But I mean, I'm sure that Stan Laurel did take into consideration. He was, I think, very smart about comedy, you know, contrast. And, you know, the pairing of Laurel and Hardy is about contrast, a skinny little guy and a big, heavy guy. And, you know, humor begins with doubles. There's two of them. They can play off each other. They can contrast each other. They can go against each other. They can pull it together and work together, you know, that kind of thing. He would be thinking about sound of voice, I'm sure. Don't you think?
I do. I absolutely do.
Yeah.
Well, Jeanine Basinger, it would just be fun to chat with you about movies all night, but I guess I'll have to let you go.
Don't tell me we're done. It goes so fast when I talk to you because you're a movie lover. It's a lot of fun to talk movies with someone who truly loves them.
Well, let's do it again soon.
Absolutely. Anytime you want.
My guest, Jeanine Basinger, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, film historian Jeanine Basinger. Be sure to pick up her most recent book, I Do and I Don't, A History of Marriage in the Movies. If you love movies, you'll love that book. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.